silhouette on a distant shore, cold like the regret in the crow's cold, the inky black sea knows it all.
It sounds so enthusiastic. It's Balls After Dark. Boom, boom, boom.
Well, my lack of enthusiasm might have something to do with one of the albums.
One of the albums. Fuck, let me guess. I don't
know any music that isn't in my genre.
That was a remarkably
I'm good supposed to be the one.
South
I'm
Park.
Supposed to be the one who's. I have lived all my life with people telling me, "You've got such a narrow choice in music. Why don't you listen to more broad stuff?" I've finally found somebody with a narrower view than me.
Hey,
I should be happier about this.
You've made me like a lot more rock music than I used to.
Where shall we start on this one?
Let's start with...
You started at the drive-in.
No, let's start with your mates. Let's start with friends or Rom.
Start with my mates. My mates, yeah. We're tight.
Oh, the thing about friends or Rom is one of those weird things where... it's one of the weird twists of Twitter where there's certain types of personalities, certain celebrities that are just quite happy to chat with you and hang out with you if you're... just an interesting person, you know. I don't give a fuck whether you're another celebrity.
Actually, that is one of the coolest things about Twitter is you think of the people who I've looked up to and enjoyed the work of who've ended up following me on Twitter as well as me following them on Twitter. I think it's probably the same story for yourself. It's like, that's actually really cool.
Mm.
It's like it's not like you're on the same level as them, but it does at least mean that they're interested in what you've got to say. And Lindsay McDougal, world's following me on Twitter. I haven't checked recently. Andrew Mulligan from Sky, who's I've always enjoyed his work. There's probably others too who I've forgotten.
Well, didn't we like
John Birmingham, of course, the godfather of this entire enterprise, basically, because we wouldn't have met each other if it wasn't for Burmo's. Probably Burmo's column in Fairfax, Brisbane. I think it's probably where we first encountered each other.
Didn't you have a little bit of to and fro with some of the guys from Grinspoon when we did the Grinspoon as a classic?
Oh, Pat. Oh, yeah, Pat. Phil. Phil liked something or other.
Hmm.
But they got a tour to. The thing is that when you've got a tour to sell, you're much more interactive, I notice.
Yeah.
The Grinspoon account's very active at the moment because they've got an album to sell.
But I think
this album, the album is called High Viz High Tea, inexplicably. They seem to have gone for a genteel garden party while ripping the shit out of the planet kind of aesthetic on the cover. I think that's what that's about.
So this album is not, like, I've never been a massive Friends or Rom fan. I don't get, as we've previously discussed on this podcast before, I don't really get that style of music. And I found myself enjoying this album regardless of all of that. It's not in my wheelhouse. I don't really understand this style of music. And I thought this was really fucking fun. I don't have much deeper thought than that on it. Like, I don't know whether it's a good example of the style.
I can cover you for that.
Yeah, I figured you'd probably have a better explanation of whether it is or not.
I can do. And that was my PhD was actually in the collected works of Friends or Rom. There's kind of two phases to Friends or Rom. There's the early phase, the kind of the... mid-90s to 2000-ish phase, which is where they were like releasing at least an album a year. You know, they released something like five or six albums in 5 or 6 years. And then in the last 15 years, they've released like four albums. It's been it's been a much more of a side project, almost like a hobby. And part of that's been because people like Jay and Lindsay went off to have careers on Triple J. And other dudes went off to play in other bands, and then various people had medical problems and injured themselves and all the rest of it. But there is a definite, there's a difference in sound between the Friends or Rom of the early 90s, the A Man's Not a Camel, Meet the Family era, Friends or Rom, and the Friends or Rom of this era. It's not a better or worse sound. It's a different sound, though. It's a sound that is more dominated by Lindsay McDougall's massive guitar masturbations. I mean, taking everything you could imagine from the wet dreams of some teenager who'd grown up on 80s cock rock, glam, hair metal, actual metal and punk, and just sort of stuffs it into the frameworks of these punk rock songs. So you end up with songs like Russell Crowe's Band's a Fucking Pile of Shit, or on this album, I suppose the equivalent is Contact. It's a punk rock song, but there's so many little cues and hints and hat tips to, I mean, even the double kicks in Contact are so fucking early, late 80s, early 90s metal. It's amazing. And that's part of how the song works, but that's just to say that there's kind of two eras of Frenzel, and we're definitely deep into the second era. I really loved Frenzel and love Frenzel, and I'm massively appreciative for all the joy they've given me over the years. If Frenzel Rom was a Twitter account, it would be Dr. Yobbo. It's loud and obnoxious and is trying to be clever, but usually just ends up saying cunt a lot. If you dig into it, it's actually quite clever, but often it's just telling people they're cunts. And both of these things can be true at the same time. You can be very clever and call people cunts a lot while throwing the horns and busting out a big riff. And that's basically the aesthetic for my Twitter account is what I learned from these guys. I always felt like that they were the Bogan Tism of punk rock.
Yeah.
Because they've got a lot of the same. And Regurgitated some of this too, although the Regurgitated were kind of the nerdier version of it. But it was that I've always gravitated towards bands with clever, funny lyrics. And while Friends of Rom are a little bit more poo and wee, they're still in that space. Which just brings me to one of my biggest complaints with this album, is that the way they've mixed it, Jay's vocals are muddy as fuck, and he sounds like he's got a busted nose. And I don't know whether that's just because as you get older, your voice does change, you get a bit lower and flatter, but he sounds low and flat and nasal, and it makes it hard to pull the cleverness of the lyrics out because you can't actually hear what the fuck he's saying.
Yeah, that is definitely a thing, and I've noticed that with who was it? It was a rock band, and I can't remember.
It narrows it down.
But the range had gone as the lead singer had gotten older.
Yep.
And that's one of the remarkable things about Bono and Mike Patton, is that they've pretty much kept their vocal range as they've aged, because it's not an easy thing to do. And probably
you got to drink a lot of your own piss to make that happen. I wonder whose piss Jay's have been drinking. Probably not. So that doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm.
So that's one of the disappointments of this album, is that I don't think it's been mixed that well. And this was a criticism of one of their other albums, one of the earlier albums that I'd never really enjoyed very much, called Shut Your Mouth, which was ironically their biggest label album. It was actually, they were signed to Sony after their early sort of late 90s success. They were signed to Sony, but the album was made under great stress and duress, and the band was falling apart, and the album was actually basically a piece of shit, and it all blew up. And that's part of that two eras of Friends of Rom thing. It's kind of the pre-Sony and post-Sony. And after Sony, it feels like they just, rather than having this sort of rushing headlong, do a release, do a tour, do a release, do a tour, it was kind of actually, we don't want to be the most famous fucking punk rock band in the world. We just want to make stuff that we're engaged with and we enjoy and we can get our message across with. And that's kind of informed where they've been ever since, I think. Mm. So it's not... I feel like it's not that well mixed. Lindsay's guitar work is tremendous on the album. Gordy's drum work is tremendous on the album, and he's absolutely fucking killing it. But when you compare it to... See, they put out a compilation a year or two ago called We Live Like Kings. It was sort of alluded, as quite a lot of their work alludes to, corruption in the New South Wales Police Force. It was... you can sort of feel the gamut of the production choices that Friends of Rome have made over the last 20 plus years. And it was much, it's very clear that it's there's something about this album that's different. And it which is odd because it's produced by the same dude and recorded in the same studio as their last album, Smoko at the Pet Food Factory. It was done by the drummer from the Descendants. And that album had some of my favorite stuff of Frenzel's on it, like Bird Attack, which my kids love. I'd love to make a compilation album of Frenzel Rom songs that my kids can listen to, but unfortunately there's about three that don't have the word cunt in them. So that's a bit frustrating, but Bird Attack was one of them. And When My Baby Smiles at Me, I Go to Rehab, which I think might be the perfect Frenzel Rom song. It's sort of short, stupid, incredible riff work, beautifully played and beautifully executed concept with amusing but also sociologically corrupt lyrics. And that's kind of what I think is the perfect Frenzel Rom song. There aren't enough of those huge high points on this album compared to a lot of their previous albums, I feel.
Well, just to go on a side tangent, one of the things I wanted to ask you about this week was I've got this little playlist that I, because I do the daycare runs that I play on the way to and from daycare, and I was after new tracks for it because playing music for three-year-olds is an interesting sort of curation because it's got to be catchy. There's got to be something that catches their attention that makes them hold on to the song. There's no rules about style. Like, you have no idea what they will find catchy. So just
but it's interesting if you look at what the Wiggles do when they're writing songs. They seem to aim for the same kind of things that people who write generic mainstream pop songs aim for.
So I'll give you the artists that I've got in the playlist so far. Baha Men, Jungle, Tegan and Sarah, The Basics, Reel to Reel, Bing Crosby, John Williamson, The Beatles, Queen, and Jack White.
Well, a lot of that that sort of 60s pop, you know, that old-fashioned idea of pop music, and probably 80s pop as well, because it was all very vanilla in terms of its lyrical content, and it was all very bouncy.
Mm.
That sort of stuff. I mean, Young Black has a CD called Pop for Tots that is full of, I think, slightly reproduced versions of, you know, Taylor Swift-y type of era pop music. But, I mean, that's all fine for the kids. The problem is you've got to listen to it too.
Mm. Well,
which is why my kids are a bit older than yours, but that's why I gave my kids MP3 players, but I curated a playlist out of all of the music on my iTunes that didn't have swearing in it.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, here, have a whole bunch of my music.
Well, the funny thing is that the top four is like Swinging on a Star, True Blue, Bicycle Race by Queen, and Hey Rain by The Basics. Like four really different songs.
But you don't have Russell Crowe's Band's a Fucking Pile of Shit.
No, not yet. But
you don't have Stand Up and Be Cunted?
So I've just added Easy by Faith No More. That they quite like that one. But they sort of they need something to catch onto. Like I think I'll add Enter Sandman back in again next week and see how they go with that. But
it might be a bit too brutal because they don't react well to. I mean, my kids react well to that stuff now. I mean, they love the shit out of Bird Attack, and Lucas loves. Lucas is a fan of AC/DC riffs.
Mm.
You know, like Thunderstruck and Back in Black and stuff like that. He's very keen on. Although I think that. Why did I use my kid's name on the fucking podcast? The younger is more into. I think he actually has some Ed Sheeran on his MP3 player.
Wow, you sure he's here?
To the point where my wife was saying, "I wonder if I should get tickets to Ed Sheeran." I'm like, he's got two songs on his MP3 player.
Let's not go too far. They can easily
be replaced by other songs that are better. I mean, Ed Sheeran's fine. What I've discovered is as I've got older and as I've spent more time on the internet, I don't just rag on people for liking stuff that's different to me anymore. I don't like there's a steampunk festival in Oamaru every year, and I think steampunk's just the biggest load of fucking flog. It's just total jizz. But I don't want to go and say that on the internet because it also doesn't hurt me in any way. It doesn't impact on my life. It makes some other people happy. I think their values are shit. I think that the whole steampunk is just complete flog. But it doesn't actually hurt me. Yeah. So why do I need to go and tell people that it's shit? And I know I get a little bit of a buzz out of ragging on something because that's why we do it. But it does, and I've had that fucking cognitive dissonance build up with me for quite a lot more in the last few years. I just would have gone, steampunk's for cunts, I hope Oamaru falls in the sea.
See, I think there's a difference between ragging on something generally, like shouting out into the void, and going...
Like this podcast.
Or going after someone, you know, who says, oh, I love steampunk. And then going at them and saying, well, I think steampunk's a shit and you must be a cunt.
Unless you've got specific sociological reasons for doing so, like, oh, the women always have to be in corsets, whereas the men can be whatever they want and you know, it's not inclusive and it's full of male predators because everything is, because it involves men. But yay, we're great.
But I have to say, just back to the kids thing,
Steampunk's fucked though, eh?
True Blue is a fantastic song for a 3 to 5 year old. It is a really well written song.
Why don't you just raid all those fucking old ABC for Kids?
Yeah, maybe
catalogs. Your Peter Coombs and your Don Spencers and your.
But I'm trying to really like. I never had music when I was growing up, so.
Oh, I had all the ABC for Kids stuff because my mum was a kindergarten teacher. So all of those Play School albums and all the ABC for Kids stuff, this was pre-Wiggles, but it was the same, effectively the same record label, if you like. It was full of Peter Coombe giving it the juicy, juicy green grass and so forth.
And I have to say, it's cheesy as fuck, but having the twins sing Hey True Blue to your back perfectly is just, it's just fucking hilarious. It just cracks me up every line. And one of the twins goes...
So this is Australian indoctrination. You're going to have them with Southern cross tats and capes, flag capes fairly soon.
And one of them even says, you know, instead of saying, standing by your mate, he goes, standing by your mate. He really accents the T. He really gets into it. And I was like, oh, mate, I can see you drinking a VB with a bluey on in a couple of years.
You're going to have to make sure that kid grows up right, eh?
But then they'll...
My kids are not going to grow up like that. They're going to be... Kind of singing, bird attack, it's a bird attack.
Well, that's the thing, but then the song of the week this week has been, you know, Bicycle by Queen, which is such a weird fucking song, like all Queen songs of that era, where it just changes like 5 times within one song. It's like Freddie Mercury can't decide what song he actually wants to fucking write.
Well, that's the kind of thing we've talked, I think, I'm sure we've talked about this before in fucking near to 100 episodes of The After Dark, but we talk about bands that liked a rock opera. Every Queen song was a rock. We did, because we talked about it when we did the Highlander.
Yeah, the Highlander soundtrack.
Every Queen song is a rock opera, and a lot of them, you know, have got multiple stages and phases within them. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody is the most obvious example, where it starts out one way and it goes through a whole bunch of different movements, almost like a classical song, and then eventually comes back to where it started from. But they'd love that. That was their whole shtick, was that sort of false operatic thing. And kids love Queen. I mean, that's you can figure out what bands kids really, really like. But in terms of other bands that I reckon you could look into, if it was stuff that I like that I think my kids would that my kids like is stuff like, they seem to like AC/DC, stuff like Spiderbait.
Yeah. Buy Me a Pony is probably a good one.
For sure. And other stuff off that album, Calypso is probably better, because instead of Cram's kind of growly voice, you've got Janet's much sort of prettier. I won't do it. You know, sunshine on my window makes me happy like I should be.
Yeah, that's a good one. Happy Land.
Regurgitators, song happy formerly Land known would, as, is a fucking perfect kids song.
Happy Land would be great, but it's not on Spotify, unfortunately.
And it's also, it's actually secretly dark.
Mm.
And that was kind of the thing. It was full of Kwan's anti-consumerist fucking communist ideals.
I was thinking...
which is why it worked, why it was great.
Because they've liked the Queen, I was thinking I'd try some Muse next week, because I think that's... It's that same sort of over-the-top ridiculousness that...
Yeah, although it tends to be more metal-y. Yeah, you'd have to find one that was more joyous,
because
I think a lot of them are more kind of Debbie Downer or dark, but... Knights of Cydonia might be cool.
Yeah.
But it is a bit kind of... And then it finally explodes into the... Yeah, it's probably too long. You really... With kids, you just really want a 2 to 3 minute pop song.
Mm. Well, I normally get about 3 songs between here and the walk to daycare. So, and then I try and get them to sing whatever they like the most on the little walk over the bridge to daycare. So,
Hoodoo Gurus, they're not on Spotify.
Yeah,
but they are perfect for this sort of stuff, because they used to just write quirky pop rock songs about dumb stuff. You know.
Mm.
Volcanoes and all kinds of waking up tired would be, it's a perfect song for the morning. It's just a simple pop rock song. And the thing about Dave Faulkner was that he was always very clear with his singing, with his lyrics. He was almost like one of these Peter Coombe, Don Spencer, ABC for Kids style artists.
Yep.
Who was singing so kids would be able to hear the words and sing along with him.
That is the genius of True Blue, is that it's so, like, it's a folk song. That's what it is. It's really an Australian folk song where the lyrics are so clear and so slow that the pacing is so slow. Like, you know, a 3-year-old can learn the lyrics pretty quickly.
Well, Rip Rip Woodchip was
the right.
Same kind of
genre. Oh, gee. We really have gone into the weeds here. Shall we talk about At the Drive-In?
Oh, I just want to finish up with Frenzel and say the other problem with this album is I mean, it's 35 minutes long, which is not bad by Frenzel Rom standards, but there's 20 tracks, and at least 5 of them didn't need to be here. And it's a little bit like that, the problem we identified with Muse and more so with Metallica is once you get to a certain stage of your career, there's nobody in the room telling you no. There are no reasonable offers refused. Everything goes on the album and there are no wrong answers. So I think 20% of the ideas in the room should have been declined.
Yeah.
And you would have got an album about the same length as Smoko at the Pet Food Factory, which is probably one of their better late era efforts. And it would have been better off. I mean, it's not fair to compare it to that classic late 90s Frenzel Rom, but if you compare it to other albums that have been released in the last 15 years by them, it's good, but it's not great. And it just misses those real fucking firecracker tracks. I mean, Cunt Act is a great single, and it is a single, even though it's got the word cunt in it a lot. But if you sort of put it on the same line as some of the other tracks like that, like Bird Attack and Russell Crowe's Band and things like that, it just doesn't have enough of what you need to make it a great album. So, but it did give me an excuse to listen to a lot of Frenzel Rom this week. I mean, I listened to this album like 7 times, I think. I listened to the best of quite a lot of times, and most of the individual albums a bunch of times as well. So, I enjoyed it. And thanks for all the music, guys. And you can keep recording it if you want to, but,
It's a little bit like the Australian Prodigy. Maybe not as strong as that Prodigy album, but it's-
no, I wouldn't have said this is as good as the Prodigy album was good compared to the other Prodigy output.
But
it's just not. There's too many misses, I think.
But
the last album you could have said that about, I think.
But the thing is that it's almost like, hey, we're old, but we still want to make music, and we can still do it. So why the fuck not?
Yeah.
You know,
and that's kind of what they are. Like last night, I watched somebody had put a video of a gig they did last year up, and part of the thing that I really loved about them was, like all good punk bands, you're supposed to have banter on stage. And that's basically how Jay and Lindsay got a job on Triple J, was based on their audition was just bantering on stage for years.
Mm.
And it was kind of heartwarming to see it still there and working, and the whole dynamic. And it was like the bits were a bit older and they were a bit more worn, but the routine still worked.
The dynamic's still there.
Yeah, and that was kind of awesome. I really enjoyed that. So they're still doing it because they want to.
Mm.
And like I said, this gig I was watching was last year when Lindsay had an eye patch because he'd had a detached retina. Jay had been in the hospital a few years ago because he had to have a pig tapeworm larva removed from his brain. I don't know how this happened because he's vegan.
I do know that story, actually.
And one of the songs on the album, which is actually one of the better songs, is called Pigworm, which talks about, you know, how he had this beautiful ideal view of the world and then realized it was a hallucination brought on by a pigworm shitting in his brain, which is kind of a metaphor for life, really. I mean, is this all a simulation? Are we all just hallucinating this experience and we all just have a pigworm shitting in our brain? There's something in that for all of us, particularly the pigworm.
Anyway,
let's move on to At the Drive-In.
Okay.
So at the Drive-In, here's the thing about At the Drive-In. Last week I verbaled them because I said I saw these guys at the Big Day Out and they gave me the shits. I didn't see them at the Big Day Out because they broke up. So at the Drive-In sort of had a couple of albums that were moderately successful, then one album that was quite successful and then immediately broke up. And splintered into, so that was the album with One Arm Scissor, I think was the biggest track off their 2000 album, Relationship of Command. And then they splintered off, and two of the guys from this band went off and formed the Mars Volta, and some of the others went off and went into Spark.
Okay, yeah, so that's split off. That I love that Mars Volta album.
That's interesting because I fucking hate the Mars Volta, and they were the band that I saw at the Big Day Out and thought, you guys are fucking dickheads. I'm not enjoying any of this. It's just incoherent shit. And I think now I understand why you hate this album, because I'm guessing by process of elimination that this is the one you don't like, unless you've suddenly decided that you don't like Battler's album because he couldn't find time to be on the pod this week.
No, this was a struggle. This fucking album, I hated it. It was just fucking...
Really? That's interesting.
It was just... unenjoyable noise.
Wow. You should try listening to the 2000 album then. Because here's what happened. So Volta were much more experimental. The thing is, my reaction to Volta was that they were much more experimental and much more difficult and difficult to approach. And that was my impression of At the Drive-In as well. I thought they were kind of difficult and screamy and discordant. And I went back and listened to their 2000 album. And it's fair to say they are screamy and discordant, and the songs don't really make any. The structures are kind of weird, and the lyrics are completely impenetrable. Whereas this album feels like that band, but they've taken a bit of the experimental weirdness out, almost like they've devolted it. They've taken out the Mars Volta bits, and what you're left with is what I found, and I know you don't share this. But I found this album oddly enjoyable.
Mm.
What I had to do was do what you do with everything, which is to take the lyrics and put them in the mental bin, yep. And not even kind of, you almost don't acknowledge that the lyrics are happening, because I looked up the lyrics on the internet. And they are literally just words that fit the meter of the song.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's got some deeper fucking meaning to them. But it is incoherent fucking bollocks.
It's impenetrable to you. And that's saying something, because you are someone that can, like, you know, really get into lyrics quite a bit.
And that's not because I can't hear what he's saying. I literally looked up what he was saying and I looked at it and went, no, that's not a sentence. That's just, what are you doing? What is this? But I enjoyed the noises they made. I enjoyed the actual riffage. I enjoyed the song structures. I wasn't expecting to enjoy them. And you can set his kind of post-hardcore Zach De La Rocha shit aside, but they weren't as bad. I kind of thought they would be more shit than this.
Yeah, I just...
And I think if you listen to their 2000 album, you'd hate them even more.
This was a struggle from start to finish. Just... Okay, I'm going to go back and listen to that Mars Volta album tonight because I can remember really liking that album.
They look like the sort of band who you would need to... You couldn't listen to in a... in a non-modified mental state.
Mm.
Because they would, because literally, I saw their set at Big Day Out, and they played like 3 songs in 40 minutes.
Oh, that's right in my wheelhouse. I love that shit.
But it wasn't pleasant noise.
No.
It was art noise. It was art installation, deliberately discordant.
Yeah,
we're making a statement noise.
Yeah, and you've got to be on the right wavelength to enjoy that sort of shit. You know, that's not Fat Freddy's three songs in 40 minutes sort of.
Yeah. That's not Led Zeppelin doing a fucking blues medley that lasts for 22 minutes, sort of. That's something slightly different.
My only thoughts when listening to this album was, fuck, I hope Dr. Yoho's got something to say about this, because my notes are, I do not like this. I do not like this at all. I do not like this, Sam.
Zeus the fucking album.
Pretty much.
I do not like it on a train. I do not like it on a plane. I will not hear it with a fox. I will not hear it in a box.
I was like, I can't Bezo this. I will cop so much shit if I Bezo this. I am going to listen to the whole album. And I got to the whole album and I was like, right, I'm not fucking doing that again.
Oh, that's interesting. How much of that is just because his voice is fucking irritating?
I found the whole thing irritating. I found his voice, the music, everything. It was just like this wall of irritating noise.
Yeah, it's got a very kind of herky-jerky staccato feel to it. It's like watching James Harden go to the line to drive to the hoop. And again, that offends a lot of people aesthetically as well.
Mm.
So maybe that's the problem. They're too much like James Harden.
Possibly.
Too herky-jerky.
At the drive-in is the James.
At the drive-in, at the drive to the hoop.
Of music.
James Harden. Some people really like it, and some people think it's a blot on the game.
Without the success.
I think what success?
Harden's had reasonable success.
Well, if he gets the MVP, he might. Other than what's he actually got to show for this year?
If you're...
Well, the thing is the way the macho narratives of the NBA run.
If you're the Minnesota,
he choked on a dick in the finals.
If you're the Minnesota Timberwolves, you would kill for Harden's success. That's all.
You
will,
but you don't have to. But you can sell the future to your shareholders, to your stakeholders.
Yeah.
Whereas Harden has to win now and failed in the biggest game he had to play. So, and that's the way bullshit narratives work. I don't know whether that applies to At the Drive-In. But, yeah, it's interesting. The interesting thing about this album, I thought, was the fact that obviously this group of people have been making music together for a long time. How they came about the decision to say, right, we're now going to make music under this band name, almost like under this brand name. How is that going to be different? Because effectively they were in the Mars Volta were around for like 15 years. So they were at the drive-in until 2000, and then they split into Mars Volta, Sparta, and there are other people involved. I'm simplifying it a bit. The Mars Volta didn't sort of decommission as a band until 2015, and that's when they started working on At the Drive-In stuff. And it's just kind of, how do you instantly go, right, we're now going to make music that sounds like this instead of music that sounds like this? It's kind of, you'd think that the creative process wouldn't be led as prescriptively as that. I wonder how the creative process actually works when you're working like that. Mm. Or is it just like us when we say we're going to do a podcast about music now instead of a podcast about sport?
Yeah. I just struggle to find, like, some of the stuff that we do, right? Like, there's always a point I can access the music. Like, there's something I can get into, whether it's the drumming or that's a really cool bass riff, or... And I just could not get there was no entry point into this album for me. It's probably one of the least enjoyable albums I've listened to in this whole After Dark experience.
That's really interesting. Now I find that really interesting because
I think this
is the most approachable album they've made. Certainly the most approachable album they've made in 15 years, because they haven't made an album in 15 years. But this is actually more approachable than anything that they've done that I know of. And normally it's me who has the strong reaction, like, this is unlistenable shit. I don't engage with this at all. So normally when you have a reaction like that, it's primarily around the vocal.
Yes, that's true. I have a problem with
it. But this is the whole thing sounds like smashing glass and dropping.
Yeah, it's just
saucepans out the window.
I found it noisy. I just found it like having a jackhammer outside of your window. That you know, that feeling where it's just drilling into your brain and you're just like, I just want this to fucking stop.
How did you listen to the album?
On the computer at work. At a reasonable volume.
All right. So speakers or?
Speakers, headphones? Yeah. Yeah, not headphones. I could not do this.
That's
on headphones.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've been exclusively headphones this week.
Yeah, so normally
different
what
sets of headphones. I've got some sets that have got more bass and some that have less.
My normal listening thing is, like, so we do this podcast on a weekend and then I listen to the albums during the week at work because I spend a lot of time in front of my computer, but I've got a pretty high-end iMac. The speakers are pretty good. And then once I've sort of had that first impression, I go back and listen to the headphones later in the week at night, you know, before bed. But I could not the visceral reaction to this was so strong. I was like, I am not fucking listening to this on headphones. So
that's really interesting. Yeah,
I said
that's really interesting a lot, but I was not. I was totally expecting when you said one of these albums was shit. And I was like, oh Christ, here we go. Punk rock is going to be a problem. He's going the pretentious art rock and blow up the punk rock. But
no, I listened to the Frenzel album and I think it's the fact that, like what you said, that there's a couple of weak songs on the album. I listened to it over sort of two or three nights on the headphones, you know, and for an album that's so short in time, you would think, oh, you just burst through it in a night, but I just listened to it in chunks and I enjoyed it, but At the Drive-In was just, it was like throwing the cross in front of the vampire and having the vampire sort of shrink back in horror.
That's the thing. Well, the Frenzel album's so short, you listen to it and you go and do something else, and then and you might listen to it again, and then after you've done that a few times, suddenly you'll start thinking of the songs, and that's when they, you know, it's when that's when it starts to take. You start thinking, the little lines of dialogue start playing out in your head, lines from lyrics, and you start thinking, oh, I'd like to hear that again. I might play the album again, and that's how that kind of worms its way in, like a pig worm lava. At the Drive-In album, it's so they don't have that ability. They've got one arm tied behind their neck because how the fuck do you remember any of the lyrics when the lyrics don't make sense and they're just screamed at you by the white Zach De La Rocha?
Man, that's a
terrible. That's kind of what he sounds like, though, isn't it? And he sounded even more like that in 2000. I don't think you want to do this, but as an intellectual exercise, you might like to go back and listen to. I mean, you probably remember One Arm Scissor.
Yeah,
as a song. Sense transmission. One Arm Scissor.
I just find that
I hated them at the time. I had no interest in At the Drive-In at the time, which is why I was so surprised to be getting At the Drive-In songs on my Discover Weekly and and B going, I don't mind this.
Look,
I quite like Hostage Stamps and Continuum, apart from the stupid fucking pretentious titles.
I'm going to be interested to go back and listen to the Mars Volta and still to see whether I still like it after this, because I remember liking it in period, which was whenever their first album came out. I think I was still
2002, right.
Yeah, that was one of the free albums I got for the alley. So I might go back and listen to that and report back next week.
Yeah, I would have seen them Big Day Out early 2004.
So should we talk Wild Colonial?
Sure, we should. We should talk about your man's band, your man's album, Battler. Now, it's always difficult talking about the art of people who we are close to, or you are close to.
But yeah, but like I said.
That said, this is the worst album I've ever heard, and I never want to hear it again. Joke.
So
you want to talk about, you said last week that this is one of your favourite, and possibly not one of, but your favourite hip-hop album, not Australian hip-hop album. No qualifiers here. Your favourite hip-hop album of all time.
And on reflection, I think it is. From start to finish, I think there's hip-hop songs that I like more. There's singles that I like more. But as an album, as a complete piece of work from hip-hop, this...
And that is the point, folks. That's what we're here to do. We are old. We care about this stuff.
This is my favourite. And the reason why is... I feel this is Australian hip-hop grown up. Like, this is hip-hop for the over-30s because it is dark.
It wasn't made by anybody who was over 30 at the time, though, was it? 2010.
He would have been over 30. It's introspective. It's not party hip-hop. It's not backyard barbecue hip-hop. It's a reflection of what this artist thinks about Australia and Australian culture.
Yeah, and you know what? And just on that point, and it's almost like the exception that proves the rule, I would say one of the misfires on this album is this song about how chicks want to pick him up all the time.
Oh, see, I just find that song hilarious because not his life, but I've lived in that scene. And that is such a I don't know whether it's accurate to him personally, but I have seen that situation play out before with bands, and so that song just it's so different to the rest of the album, but it just makes me laugh every time, and it brings back sort of memories of stories from artists and particular live gigs that I've been to. It just rings true it rings true to me. It doesn't seem like a boast. It's just like this funny little anecdote that someone would tell you after you've had a few beers after a gig.
So it works as an in-joke for people in the industry.
Yeah, it does.
It doesn't work outside that.
No, it completely... The funny thing is, it is so outside the rest of the mood of the album. Like the rest
That's kind of the thing. That's what sort of stands out like a sore thumb compared to the rest of it. And it's not to say it's a fucking horrible track. It's just this kind of a... It's such a tonal change from the themes that he explores in the rest of it, which is... It's quite grand, the Wild Colonial, the idea of exploring Australian colonial, like the colonisation of Australia and the cultural impacts of that, and the fact that they're obsessed with drinking and the racial stuff that's come from that, and sort of people that we've turned into, and as a result of that, which seems to be an overarching theme that flows through the whole piece.
So
I'm talking like it's a piece of art. It's a piece of art.
The funny thing is hip hop in Australia, or hip hop everywhere, like American, English, and I'm talking here about sample based hip hop, like samples American culture, particularly American movies, like old American movies, old westerns, old whatever, but it tends to sample American culture more than anything else. And this album samples all Australian culture. All the vocal samples that are layered into this, they're clipped from old Australian colonial type movies. Like,
you mad, you bastard.
Yeah, they're a weird mob is in there. Storm Boy, Wake in Fright, Stone, you know, you're talking about sort of older Australian classic, real Aussie ochre sort of movies, and it gives it a flavour, a time and place that no other Australian hip-hop album has. And that's what I love about it. It's such an Australian... It's a little bit confronting, especially that Have a Beer interlude, you know, have a beer with me, you bastard. Yeah, it's such a... it's sort of like
But it's straight dialogue from the movie. But that's what makes it a... It's not like it's been taken out of context. It's a literal discussion of the fact that of this post-colonial machismo mindset that you can do anything you liked. You can destroy all the resources around you. You can be horrendous to the people who love you. You're in your family. You're supposed to be supporting you, but you have to hold up this bullshit toxic masculinity. Otherwise, the whole thing falls down around your ankles.
Mm.
And that's all a result of colonialism. That's all a result of the fact that they came here as settlers or as convicts and in primarily male, white environs.
So I asked Battler about that because I think it is the darkest album that Australian hip-hop has ever produced. Australian hip-hop can produce these really introspective songs that are quite cutting on social commentary, and Hilltop Hoods are actually quite good at it. They've got quite, like, When the Seasons Change or Stopping All Stations are two really good songs looking deep into the Australian psyche, but they're songs on an album. They're like the light song that is on this album. They're like dark songs on a lighter album, whereas this is the flip side. This is a dark album. So I asked Battler about that, and he's like, well, I'm just...
He said, that old piece of shit, fuck, I don't play that anymore. What the fuck are you listening to that for?
Well, his thing was he basically has a feeling that the human race is sort of deeply flawed and you know, he has a negative outlook on life, I guess, and he said that
I know, I've seen his tweets about basketball.
might
be just being a self-loathing OKC fan.
But that comes through, and he said, I don't know if you've seen the movie Animal Kingdom, which is an Australian movie, which is it's sort
Ben Mendelsohn's in that, isn't it?
It's
profoundly fucked up Western suburbs.
I think it's Melbourne, but it's like a.
Yeah.
It's like a criminal.
They have Western suburbs in Melbourne.
It's like a criminal family, but it's like the whole theme of that movie and the whole and I like movies like this, which is that inevitable sucking back of despair where you would like to be more than you are, but you're you're striving for something more than you are, but your situation is just dragging you back down.
And you like seeing people brought down by their circumstances.
Well, it's like
you're a sick motherfucker. This is the theme of a lot of those, particularly sort of crime movies. Fucking The Godfather. Every time I think I get out, every time I'm out, they drag me back in, sort of thing. Fucking Mendelsohn's been in a bunch of these sorts of movies. Hitbox with David Season made. It was basically,
But it lies to that, and I think this is a particularly apt sort of observation of the time we're in now, where you have all these motherfuckers that are born into privilege going, just try harder. If you try harder, you'll succeed. And it's like, no, you know, your grandfather gave you $100,000 when you were 23, and that's why you have a property empire now. Or, you know, you've been gifted these enormous advantages, and if you haven't been gifted these enormous advantages, sometimes it doesn't matter how fucking hard you try, you're not going to be able to drag yourself out of the dirt. And that is the feeling that I get pervades this album, is that you can try all you want in a very, like, Australia is about a fairer country as you can live in. Like, we're not living in...
Well, it certainly views itself as that.
We're not living
know.
In.
I very much doubt how much how true that is these days.
We're not living in Turkey, you know. We're not living in Iran.
I mean, in terms of political freedom, I thought I was talking more in terms of economics, in terms
yes.
of your ability to buy a house or your ability to.
Yeah,
that sort of stuff has gone to hell.
But it's that, you know, living on the poverty line, living on the, not even the poverty line, but you know, living from paycheck to paycheck, that sort of low-grade despair, that low-grade depression that can, you can have.
Pointlessness of existence, that subsistence level, I'm just scraping to exist, I'm not actually living, all I'm doing is surviving.
Yeah,
what's
like,
the fucking point? Why don't I just and again, a lot of Australian cinema looks into this, doesn't it? The why don't I just fucking pull bongs and rob service stations?
Yeah, and like you can actually be quite successful professionally or socially, but you can be living right on the edge. And I always think about I can't remember that. There's a name of an exercise that basically says if you cut off the food supply. Like if you stop the machine working, if you stop those trucks coming in from the farms in the country into the cities, how long would it take society to break down? You know,
aren't we only ever 3 miles from a right from a revolution?
Yeah, so that's the sort of feeling I get from this album is, you know, you're only a couple of bad things happening to you away from being in this mindset, you know, don't be complacent. Look at Australian society and there is a darker side to it that you don't quite understand. And I just feel that feeling comes across so strongly in it that. That's why I love this album, because I think it's articulated in the music, in the tone, in the lyrics, everything about it. And I know I'm attracted to more depressive, dark music, and that's why I like this album more. But I think it's just articulated perfectly for Australia.
I didn't see so much of the human nature is inherently dark and worthless and problematic. I got the our culture is built on dark and problematic building blocks.
Mm.
But I didn't get that as a statement about the quality, you know, the quality of human experience. But if what you've said is what you've taken of it, isn't that fucking song about pulling chicks in the bar even more discordant and silly?
Yeah, I know.
This is like, we're all fucked, but geez, I get some poontang. I mean, I'm trying to deny it. I'm trying to actually, no, to be honest, most of that song was fine. It was just the extended part where she's trying to pick him up and he's trying to say, no, I believe in my art. I must get an early night so I can be an artist. Yeah, she goes, no, I'm desperate. Can you look at my boobies? No, it was just, oh, come on, man.
The funny thing is, I have seen.
It may well have happened.
I have seen so much more ridiculous stuff than that in real life, like stuff that you could put.
An album about how fucked Australian macho culture is.
It's a bit funny, isn't it?
Is this going to be the time I slagged Earth Boy off for writing an album about property values thing? It needs to be said. This is a fucking good album. It's really good. I didn't necessarily pick up some of that nuance that you've picked up. I don't know whether that exists or whether you're reading between the lines, but it actually is really cool. The questions I'm obviously interested to talk to you about if we had a chance to was sort of how he goes about writing songs. I mean, how long he's worked with his current DJ, with that DJ, and how they structure that writing process. I mean, are they
so this is one of the guys from The Herd, and I think the thing is that they've worked together for so long. I think it's not like I write all the lyrics, I send you the lyrics, you write the beats, you send them back to me, and we work from there. I think it's just like a constant back and forth.
Yeah,
hey, I've got this beat. this beat's
what,
quite,
can you do something with it? Yeah.
This beat's quite dark, you know. Oh, okay, well, I've got some really dark sort of thoughts about colonialism kicking around. I'm going to write a song about this. And
yeah. You've got something I can pick up chicks to. Well, you've got something that I can try and pretend I'm not picking up chicks to, but chicks are throwing themselves at me too.
So, yeah, I think because those guys have worked together for so long, it's not like, you know, that classic sort of MC and producer sort of aesthetic where, you know, send me some beats and I'll write some stuff to it. I think it's a little...
Because, as you know, I'm interested in creative processes. I'm interested to know how people build, particularly in collaborative processes, you're writing... songs you might write the song and then build the lyrics around it. You might have the lyrics as a finished structure and be trying to fit songs to fit it. But I have more of an understanding of that in the traditional band sense. How you do that with hip hop, where you build a song almost like it's out of Lego. You build it from its component parts, you know, out of the samples and out of the beats and all that sort of stuff. And it's modular. You can pull bits out and add different bits in. In a much different way to the way that you do with writing, you know, three chord punk rock songs, for example.
Yeah, so going back over this album, it's definitely my favorite hip hop album. It's just such an outlier. Like there's not really been anything like this. Lazy Grey writes songs like this, but he. Like his albums default back to that real smash mouth sort of.
Hey, now you're an all star.
No, it's like.
It's not the sound I thought you'd get from Lazy Grey.
What's
his Twitter account like? Because I understand Smash Mouth are quite active in that respect.
There's a real Brisbane sort of sound, which is like a real rough, blunt sort of beats style.
And I see what you did there.
And every now and again, he writes a song like Stop and Think, which is just has this incredible flow. And I'm like, oh, I wish you'd write an album like this. But it's not within the cultural style that fits it. So that's why I don't have a Brothers Stoney or a Lazy Grey album that's my favourite album. But this album just suits the style that I am, you know, down to the bone. So,
yeah. Although I just checked the track listing of that album, and I don't remember getting the same. Yeah, I still don't remember getting that same tone of the futility of human existence out of it. I certainly got the, you know, songs like Distant Shore and Wild Colonial and so forth about Australian culture and obviously some of the interludes. But a lot more of it's about... Anyway, you've listened to this album, I would say, about 97 times more than I have.
Probably, yeah. Distant Shore is just a fantastic fucking song too. So, new stuff, man, I tell you. This week was a struggle.
Oh, good. I'd hate to think your incredible track record of producing winners would be in danger.
I don't know whether I'm going to I'm basically taking two flyers this week. Strangely enough, I don't know that like the stuff that I've had off Discover Weekly. Lately, I've not really liked the single. But anyway, I'm going to go Slow Dive by Slow Dive.
Oh, Slow Dive are a British shoegaze band.
Okay.
So they like Jesus and Mary Chain style band. Similar kind of, they were around in the early 90s. And then they fucked off, and now they've made a belated comeback. And of course, it has to be an old band that's making a comeback because it is one of your picks.
Well, I didn't think that would be the.
I think simply because there's so many of them, they're going to be more prevalent in Spotify listings like this.
Well, I thought with a self-titled album, it would actually be the opposite. I thought it would be it would be a debut band, you know, because like
That's interesting because the late career self-titled album is often a an attempt to kind of rebrand or rebirth yourself. Like
That's why I picked it because I was like, "Oh, this has to be a."
That was the one.
It's a little bit like it's a little bit like the Funkors doing the Greatest Hits album as their second album.
For sure. All right. So I've heard a little bit about that, but I haven't heard any of it. So what else do you have on the ledger for the next week, Mr. Beasley?
Well, I'm going with the Afghan Whigs, not Wings.
Afghan Whigs.
Whigs in spades, Whigs. Mostly because it's got like a dude that looks like a devil on the front cover.
I have heard of them. I don't know what they sound like.
So that
should be kind of cool.
What
style of music are the Afghan Whigs?
I have no fucking idea. Let's have a look at their Spotify about.
This is encouraging.
Yeah.
When you say flyers, you mean things you've not even listened to, like a track of.
It's stuff that I've got in my saved albums list for 2017.
At some stage, you've listened to something.
Garage punk band in the vein of The Replacements, Dinosaur Jr., and Mudhoney.
Oh. All right. I assume with a name like the Afghan Whigs, they were like spaced out 60s psychedelia. Like the Persian Rugs, which is like a Hoodoo Gurus side project that just played 60s Farfisa organ bloody spaced out jams.
Unfortunately, they're a 90s band. So once again, I managed to pick two old fucking bands instead of something new. But anyway.
Good news. I think for next week I've got a bunch of old bands coming back as well.
Okay.
Because I've already got it programmed because I've checked when certain albums were coming out. So, yeah, it's just going to be the... We'll suss that. No, next week is open.
I went through... So I've got a... There's a really good Wikipedia page with all the albums released in 2017. And I went back and had a quick listen to anything I thought looked interesting, and there was just nothing that grabbed me in May at all. And I was like, "Oh well, I'll go back to my saved albums playlist on my flyers and have a look."
This is like my experience with New Zealand Music Month. I can listen to every new New Zealand release that's coming out this month. Oh, yeah. Christ, so bad.
Yeah.
All right, next week, note to self, I'll try and pick a couple of debut albums from bands that neither of us have heard of before. Just often because that, or at least so albums by bands neither of us have heard of before, because that's how we ended up with quite a lot of good stuff. But for this week, I have to pick a classic album. And sometimes we do a thing where we pick a classic album that neither of us actually think is a classic, but the world does. And this week it was made very clear to us that the world thinks a certain album that turned 50 on the 1st of June is a classic album. I don't think either of us have ever expressed an opinion that this album is a classic or that this band is anything other than overrated boomer bait. But I think, bound as we are as music critics, we need to listen to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Oh, wow. Is
which
that
is apparently
come on
the
next
number
week?
One album. Apparently, this is the number one album in the UK this week.
Oh, my God.
It's jumped back to the top of the charts because of the 50th anniversary, because of the nostalgia kick, because it was released 50 years ago on the 1st, which is Thursday this week. What I love seeing on Twitter was Generation X music critics clapping back at older music critics who were faffing on about the glory of this album. Bernard Zool was sort of saying, imagine being in 1967, you know, spaced out on acid, listening to this album for the first time, And Steph Howard quote tweeted it and said, yeah, it'd still be tosh. Which I think is just... That's the dialogue I'm interested in. Is this album, I'm sure, in its time?
Funnily enough, one of the tracks off this album is on my daycare playlist, A Day in the Life.
Well, of course it would be, because if you look at all the Beatles stuff, as I mean, Adam has said the best album, if he was going to pick a classic album, would be the Beatles 1, which is all their number one hits. Because they released like 12 studio albums over the course of their roughly eight, nine-year career. And there were shitloads of really good singles on there. But the question is, were any of the albums actually great end to end? And boomers say yes, but I don't know how many people have actually listened to that many of the albums.
Mm.
So it's kind of, and I'm not going to say I have either, but.
I like the title track. And I like, man, this has got When I'm 64, which is a really fucking cheesy song.
I know. The thing is that at this stage, they were supposed to be experimental fucking, you know, the new, because the album before was sort of the point at which they started doing it, Revolver. But this is supposed to be the album where they said, okay, we're no longer your chintzy pop artists. It would have been like Ed Sheeran or fucking someone like that just going, right, now I'm in a fucking death metal band. But there was still, but I'm still going to do fucking a ukulele solo on one of the songs. And it's kind of, they went from being, if you listen, I mean, the first couple of albums are all very generic R&B pop songs. You to make them important and listenable, you have to think, well, what else was around in 1962? Fucking Elvis and the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Which we were great in their time, but it's kind of, you're grading on a curve whenever you're doing comparisons to albums of this era. But the thing I'm interested in is that a couple of albums from this is 1967. 1967 was also the year that Jimi Hendrix released Are You Experienced? And I think it's the year that, I'd have to check this, but I thought that was the year that Cream did Disraeli Gears. Those are two excellent albums, end to end, that are interesting, that take that pop sensibility and bring in psychedelic rock and do some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I might go back and listen to Disraeli Gears, because I haven't listened to that album in ages.
That's a really fucking, and that's on my shortlist for, that's a classic album I want to get to at some stage, but in terms of, it's always put forward as this major step change in what popular music was. I'm just wondering whether it was just a major step change in what mainstream, like super mainstream popular music was. It'd be like saying, oh, wow, Taylor Swift's just reinvented a genre when all she's done is done 10% of what some more adventurous artist has been doing on the fringes for years.
Mm. It's a little bit like watching Pulp Fiction. Like you go back and watch Pulp Fiction now or... The Usual Suspects, and it's like they're still amazing movies. Or probably, actually, the perfect example is The Matrix, Bullet Time in The Matrix. Like, when you first saw Bullet Time in The Matrix, it was like, holy fuck, I can't believe someone is doing that. And now a million different movies have done that effect. And it loses its value a little bit. And the really, really, really good filmmaking or music still holds up no matter how much it's been imitated, because it is so good.
Depends how easy the trick is to imitate, though, I suppose.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, because at that stage, the bullet time trick was really hard to fucking do, but now...
Because you throw processing power at it.
Yeah, it's, you know... Anyone can do it. It's like a cheap gimmick. It's like, you know, it's like $2. It's like something from the $2 shop. So,
and that's also a part of this. I'm interested to see how much stuff like Oasis has, and Jet and other bands that have used some of these. I mean, even we were talking about the other week with Regurgitator. Some of the tracks on Unit have got that kind of later Beatles. Harmony structure, if you like. that how much of that being used as a thing, as almost like a meme, as a standalone trope, affects your enjoyment of the original source material. Whether you can put that aside and go, well, hang on, these guys were doing it earlier. Or whether it just ends up coming out as cheese.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's a good one. I like that one. That's interesting. The thing is that
it was being mentioned so many times this week. It was like, I kind of feel like we need to do this because we've done this before. We did this with Stone Roses, and I think you had one as well, didn't you? Where you popped one up.
I can't remember what it was, but yeah, that was one.
I can't remember off the top of my head what it was either.
And there was another one that I was going to do recently, and I went back and listened to a couple of songs and went, I'm not that keen on that. But the other good thing about this one compared to the Friends or Ramen Regurgitator is that I'll be able to listen to this in the car with the kids.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, you will be able to listen to this one in the car with the kids. You do have to salute that. I mean, we'll probably talk more about this isn't really a story about is this the best Beatles album, because we're not going to go and listen to 12 Beatles albums. It's not a question about it's just a question about is this a, because it's almost become like a meme on the internet, like, because it was what, even a couple of weeks ago, someone was posted today in today on this doesn't stand up anymore. We look at the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's become sort of a thing that this album is not as good as the boomers would tell you. And I wonder where the truth lies with this.
Well, it's a little bit like us going back and listening to OK Computer, where I can disassociate all the stuff that's come after and you can't.
Well, I've got different issues with that album, but it's also, but that's only 20 years. I mean, if we
that's what I'm saying. Like, it's going to be
somebody who wasn't around when it came out the first time. So if we go back and listen to, it kind of has to be not an album from the 90s, but an album from the 80s or the album from the 70s, like early AC/DC or something like that. It's got to be something whereby you didn't have the original. You don't have the nostalgia link to the experiences you had. You can't remember being at that open air gig in fucking Hyde Park, seeing them play. You got to take all that out and just say, "Well, is this good music or not?" And that's kind of that's the way the problematic shit lives.
Yep.
And that's why the album's getting dragged on the internet for not being cool.
That's a good one. I'll try and go into this one with an open mind. All right, Doc. That was
not just doing this to troll people who like.
Yeah, that Adam.
Yeah, because he's the only person. He's the only person under 40 who likes the Beatles.
Who we tried to troll last week and skipped our whole troll intro, which was fantastic.
I feel like we've been trolled. We managed to put a fucking theme song on the album on the podcast, which is basically a Def Leppard song. Although the hidden troll in picking a Def Leppard song for the theme is that it's a Def Leppard song and it's probably the best thing they ever did, but it's a cover of a Sweet song because everything else Def Leppard did was shit house.
And it completely missed its mark, and we'll probably go back to the Damien Lillard opening soundtrack. Just
well, you can't go wrong with Bug Powder Dust.
That's true. All right, Doc. I'll say the same thing I said in the main podcast,
which was to get cut off by your internet dropping out.
Give us a retweet on Twitter, share us on Facebook.
We'd love a bit of signal amplification.
If iTunes actually lets you do such a thing, like us on iTunes, but get us out there. We've been doing some good stuff.
I think the traditional thing to say at this time is to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes with lots of stars on it, because apparently that makes iTunes more inclined to recommend it in their. Well, this might be a podcast you might like to listen to. We had some very kind feedback from people who listened to the show. It said that our last episode was excellent. I'm not convinced that that's correct because I was
because we were involved
far too drunk to be allowed to be talking on the internet at that stage, particularly when getting into the area of cultural appropriation.
And
who should be allowed to write characters of different genders and ethnicity to themselves.
It was an interesting conversation anyway.
Yeah, interesting as in may you live in interesting times, Confucius style.
All right, Doc, I'll catch you on the flip side.
Interesting the way the at the drive-in are interesting.
Yeah, maybe. See ya.
See ya.